General Menezes, Real 4. We'd like to know what the background was to you deciding to stay in the army rather than, as originally intended, converting, you know, to the civil service when the war was over. Could you go a bit into the background of that decision for us?
The British government, both in Britain and India, had, shall we say, as I said, introduced emergency commissions for the duration of the war. At the end of the war, we were eligible to apply for permanent regular commissions, or of course, apply for the civil services. On the advice of my then commanding officer, Colonel Bolter, I initially applied for a permanent regular commission because the option would thereafter still be open of going to the civil services, depending on the situation. So I attended the permanent commission board for those of us who were Indian Emergency Commission officers, and was given one of the highest gradings, a half a dozen of us being graded 2 amongst several, about 13 to 14,000 being graded 2, because the British had a 7-point scale, grade 7 for the failures, grade 1, shall we say, absolutely top, and then grade 2 for outstanding. So when I got this letter from the then General Headquarters Selection of Personnel Directorate that I'd been placed in grade 2 and was acceptable to be commissioned into the regular Indian Army, I went to my commanding officer, Colonel Bolter, for advice. So he said that it would be better that I stayed in the army than going on to a civil services interview, because it was preferable to stay with the devils I knew rather than the devils I didn't. Secondly, that with independence being around the corner and there would possibly be the inevitable disturbances, it would be better to be behind the gun than in front of it. And as always in life, a bird in the hand was worth two in the bush.
So you were commissioned when?
A permanent regular commission I was given, awarded in 1945, but seniority was back to my original commission in 1943.
It was December 45.
The gazette notification was December 45, but I was then gazetted as a substantive lieutenant, a more substantive captain, because I'd been an acting major for several months now and was then deemed to be a temporary major.
Now, what kind of operations were you doing from Gardai? I'm particularly interested in the punitive expeditions led by Colonel Bolter against local villages. Could you tell us a bit about the background of this?
The most frequent operation was the thrice weekly road opening to ensure the supplies could come up to us and further up the road to Rasmuk. But the operation, the actual punitive columns were not conducted by Colonel Bolter on his own. They were under the brigade commander of Gardai Brigade, Brigadier Johnson. So as a brigade column, we would move out. We would have a political officer with each battalion, and the story that is often narrated was at the end of the day's operations, as we advanced towards the Fakir of Epi's stronghold at a place called Gorwekt, the political officer would come back to the mess, and not in ours but in another unit's mess, and say, and what was your catch today, ours, that is, from the tribesman point of view. He would describe as a catch for the tribesmen of so many British or Indian troops that were killed, because the political officers were very identified with the tribesmen, considering them noble people, but insofar as we were concerned, at least in the Indian Army, they were not freedom fighters as such, but more freebooters.
Now, Colonel Bolter had a particularly vigorous policy, what he called prophylactic fire. Could you tell us about that?
Colonel Bolter, from his earlier experience in another battalion in what was called the Fort Sandwin or Zob area, he had come to the conclusion that the only way of advancing against the Pathans was not to wait till you're fired at, but to, shall we say, plaster a village with fire, both small arms as well as guns, if necessary, to make sure that the tribesman was not in a position to fire at you, because after all, he was in a, the tribesman was on higher ground, and you were sort of in these defiles, moving along with your mules. So he favored the concept. It was not introduced by him, but it was something that he had picked up during his service, of prophylactic fire. That is, that you did not incur casualties, but you inflicted casualties on the tribesmen. That was not particularly liked by the political officer, because they argued that innocent goat herds may be killed in the process. Bolter's argument was more specific, that they would could be seen with arms, and in many cases often aiming their weapons at us through binoculars. But again, the political officer would counter by saying that they were only playing games. They were not actually going to fire, because the bright price in the Northwest frontier was often as not, whereas other parts of India, it could be a cow or a camel, as the case may be. Here it was a rifle. But they complained to our general officer commanding, who was of the same regiment, Major General Roger Le Fleming. He came down and tried to impose on Colonel Bolter that he stop this practice of prophylactic fire. But Colonel Bolter refused, his argument being that the lives of one of his troops were more precious than that of any tribesman who already had been warned the day before not to move out of his village, and therefore should not have been there at all.
Now, you used pickets, part of your job was, can you tell us about the pickets on either side of the column?
There were two forms of pickets. One was the static ones that were there put out around your perimeter camp so that the Pathans could not snipe at you from the adjacent features. And there were the mobile pickets that you put up when you yourself were on the move, because you could not travel along these defiles unless your security was ensured from the adjacent heights. So the only way was to picket the features as you advanced, and to leave those pickets in position till such time as you withdrew, because otherwise the tribesmen would ambush you and inflict serious casualties, which they often did on some battalions. As I say, we were the only battalion that did our spell in Waziristan without a single human casualty. The only injury or wound suffered was by a mule, and that was when Colonel Bolter was on leave in Britain, especially in the war leave. Possibly even that mule injury could have been avoided.
Now, he often used to chivvy you up about speed. Tell us about the story.
Yes, when we were occupying, moving up to pickets, he felt that I was not moving fast enough. These features were in the area of 6,000, 7,000 feet, so you had to get breathless in any case. But our so-called manpack set was a misnomer. It was maybe manpack in the plains, but when you were climbing up, it was quite a burden for the signaler to carry it. So if I left him behind, he would become a straggler and be picked up by the Pathans and mutilated. I can give you the quotation from Kipling later as to what the tribesmen did. But nevertheless, he would on occasion call me up and say that I was not moving fast enough. So I said that I had to ensure the security of my wireless operator with this heavy set. He would say, "Well, Major Menezes, if you don't hurry up, you'll be Captain Menezes." So as we climbed the feature, progressively he called me to the set and said, "Captain Menezes, you're here by Lieutenant Menezes." Anyway, I took it in good spirit, and at the end of the day, when we had withdrawn our pickets and come into the camp, in the mess, he'd forgotten all about it. He was a great man that way.
Now, what about the accommodation overnight or at Gardai?
The accommodation at Gardai was in what we called Wana huts, wherever you had a perimeter camp on the frontier. In terms of past experience, it was felt that the tribesmen could snipe you if they got through in between your standing pickets, even outside the camp. So therefore you had your perimeter wall to safeguard you when you stood through, and you had a kind of wall enclosure where you slept. But overhead you did not have the timber to construct the roof, so that they were tent flies of a tent called the, at that time, Indian pattern tent. So this Wana hut was standard accommodation in all perimeter camps in the frontier, built by troop labor, tent flies supplied by the ordnance. And you handed this over when you were relieved in a particular perimeter camp.
Now, what would you do when you actually got to the village that was that you were going to punish? Well, I mean, this is really just to make it clear that you didn't massacre the inhabitants of the village. I just want you to explain what you did.
Well, if the political officers would tell them to hand over the weapons that they may have captured from some other unit or some other formation, and if they refused to do so, a negotiation would go on with the headman, and well, if he wasn't able to recover the weapons that had been stolen or looted, then the decision would be taken by the GOC or the brigade commander in consultation with the political officers to destroy the village. That threat would then be given to the headman again, and if he still was unable to hand over the particular weapons, then in that case the village will be cordoned off. The political officers, through his agents who were called Khasadars, would then withdraw all the women, children and men, or old men in the village, and after the political officer had given the clearance, the headman had certified the village was now empty, then the village would be destroyed. Initially by mountain artillery, 3.7-inch howitzers, and then with what was left, the troops going in and setting it afire using kerosene.
Now, how important was the role of the RAF? Because that had been very important in the 20s and 30s in sort of attacking villages and things in the Afghan wars. How important was the RAF in this particular, these operations?
They were useful for purposes of reconnaissance, because the situation had developed from the period 1919 when they were first deployed at a place called Miran Shah next to Dumdil, next to Gardai. So at that particular point of time, it even bombed, one lone plane had even bombed Kabul, which had led to the then Emperor, the then King Nader Shah eventually withdrawing. But the point does remain that the tribesmen had been alerted to the RAF. So therefore, he had already excavated caves in various places for purposes of his own protection. So by and large, while we were there, there was no profitable target for the RAF to engage. So they were more used for daily reconnaissance of the route or the communications that we were using at that particular point of time.
Are there any other stories you remember from this time or any incidents you recall from these operations, either clearing the road for the supply column or actually punitive expeditions?
No, you see, with Colonel Bolter, he was so efficient that there was no occasion for any incidents as such, because he was one step ahead of the tribal anyway. What the situation would have been in relation to other commanding officers, I would not know, because I know that this perimeter camp had the graves of numerous soldiers of other battalions. But we had no occasion to have anybody killed in our own battalion. So, because as I said, we were one step ahead of the tribesmen.
So what happened next? What's the next thing you recall?
I was then, having been gazetted as a permanent regular commission officer in December 1945, it sort of coincided with the rundown of the post-war rundown of the Indian Army.
Now tell me about that. How did it affect you, or what could you see of it? Not so much what you know of it now, because I know you've done a history, but what at the time did you see of it?
At that particular point of time, in early 1946, the orders came for my particular battalion, the 5th, 4th Bombay Grenadiers, which had now been changed from November 45 into the 5th Battalion Indian Grenadiers, to be disbanded. You see, the youngest battalions of all regiments were being progressively disbanded in the post-war rundown. Field Marshal Auchinleck had established what was called a Wilcox Committee to go into the strength of the post-war Indian Army. So the Wilcox Committee had come up with a strength of 280,000. At that particular point of time, the Indian Army in December 45 was 2.5 million. So obviously the Indian Exchequer could not afford this amount of expenditure, the war now being over, because the British government would only pay for Indian troops that were deployed during the war outside India, and the British government was not prepared to continue fostering such a large force. Particularly Churchill was totally opposed. In fact, he debunked the strength of the Indian Army, saying that it was too bloated, too fat. However, with this Wilcox Committee having arrived at a figure of 280,000 as to what the peacetime strength of the Indian Army should be, the disbandments had started in all regiments. So the 5th Battalion received its orders in 1946, and I was in anticipation of disbandment, I was posted out to what was called the Indian Army Selection Board for Permanent Regular Commissions.
Now, how did you feel about the disbandment of the 5th, 4th Bombay or Indian Grenadiers as well then?
It was a very sad decision, particularly for a person like Colonel Bolter, who had built it up from the morass that it was in with the previous commanding officer. To his dying day, he would sit looking at the pictures of the 5th, 4th Bombay Grenadiers. And you can't say he was chagrined, his heart was broken by the decision. But then the point is, that was a decision on all army bases, not necessarily only directed at the 5th, 4th Bombay Grenadiers, or as I say, the 5th Battalion Indian Grenadiers at that particular point of time. His argument was that they should have looked at the efficiency reports of every battalion at that particular point of time in early 46, and disbanded the more inefficient ones.
Not on seniority then, but on efficiency.
Yes. But the point is, the British, apart being fond of tradition, it was an easier parameter to implement if you went on the oldest battalions being disbanded rather than younger battalions who had more tradition. So we were a wartime regime. It had existed up to the 5th Battalion had existed up to 1923. So in the rundown, it was a regular battalion at that time, but in the rundown of the Indian Army after World War I, it was disbanded. It was then the 112th Infantry. It was disbanded in 1923. Now, Bolter's point was not accepted. His rule was not accepted because that would have gone against the grain for all the regiments. So it was a shattering blow for him, so he promptly took special end-of-war leave. And I myself was posted. So I asked him what to do. Should I represent? He said, no, the battalion is being disbanded, you go.
Now, you were posted to the 71st Regular Commission Selection Board. Is that
yes.
Was it Meerut?
Meerut, which is a big cantonment outside Delhi.
It's my reading of the writing there, sorry. Meerut, yeah. Now,
Meerut.
Can you tell us a little about the work of the selection board?
So I was a senior group testing officer. You had a full colonel, British, as the president. You had an Indian lieutenant colonel as a deputy president. And depending on the intake, there were senior group testing officers. In addition, you had a psychiatrist, and you had what were called psychological pointer writers, usually women of the Women's Auxiliary Corps. So you had these what were called thematic apperception tests, which were applied, projected onto the wall, and they were designed by psychologists in Britain in order to get you to reveal your feelings as to what those images represented. And from that they could gauge whether you had a negative or positive personality. In addition, you had what were called the inkblot test, which are called the Rorschach tests. And these also were, from a psychological point of view, thematic apperception.
What did you think of these psychological tests? Do you think they worked? Were they good?
Well, from the point of view that I had got a high grading, I can only conclude that they were correct, because, from a subjective point of view, but presumably they had been tested over a wide sample in Britain from the point of view of psychological reactions or perceptions. So, and they had been, shall we say, proved right.
So what now? So there was a psychological test. What else would there go on at the board?
There were the verbal aptitude tests. That is, they were both largely mathematical. That is, 1, 3, 5, what comes next, that kind of thing. So series, multiple answer tests. So within a particular span of time, you had to answer about 100 questions. I would say that the tests were valid or had been validated, because not only were they being given to officers for purpose of being given emergency commission officers for purpose of being given regular commissions, a separate sample, but a separate matrix, had been evolved for other ranks to be retained in the regular army, and they were the pinpoint tests, putting the block tests, that kind of thing. So I would say, from the point of view of psychological perceptions, these tests had all been validated, and I would say they were valid.
And was there an interview as well that you'd take part in, or?
Yes, the procedure for the board was that there would be group tests. That is, shall we say, a white line here and a white line there, and you'd be given a couple of cabers, or bullies as we call them in India, and the group would have to then cross without, shall we say, this no man's land in between. So you had these group tests, which were conducted by people like myself, the senior group testing officer. And to answer your question about the interviews, the president would interview, the deputy president would interview, and the psychiatrist would interview. So you had three interviews, and you had the senior group testing officers, that is, in these group tests. That is, you take an animal transport cart. You would have to then take it across from this side to that side without entering the so-called no man's land.
So now, how many would you pass? Because the Indian Army was being cut to the bone. Was there a need for more officers? Do you see what I mean?
No, there was a need to reduce the number of Indian commissioned officers, for the simple reason that you would not need at that particular point of time.
So these weren't new officers, they were existing officers that you were deciding who were the best.
There were boards they had been boards to take in Indian Emergency Commission officers. But now these boards were changed to take in Indian Emergency Commission officers as regular commissions. For example, I had not been before a similar selection board at that particular point of time in 1943, because that was done largely on an interview by what was called the Provincial Board and the Federal Public Service Commission at Delhi. So now we were being put through the psychological test to see if we were psychologically suitable for the armed forces. And there's no doubt that I do feel that the ones who were placed in the lower grades were unsuitable for regular commission in the Indian Army.
What proportion would you pass?
There was no proportion as such. It was entirely on the assessment.
What would that result in? How many would you end up passing?
No, see, we didn't have a pass viewpoint as such. As far as the British pattern was concerned, it was 1 to 7. 7 was definitely a failure.
It's the same 7 grades as you'd had, but informed to other testing.
No, I mean as far as the testing is concerned, as a group testing officer, I did not give a grade. I only gave a pen picture. I gave a pen picture, you said. So, at the end of the situation, my report went to the president, and he would decide the grade with the pen picture by the deputy president and the psychiatrist.